Hey, welcome to this episode of Light 'Em Up. We take a deep dive on the criminal justice system, crime scene investigation, and leadership. We enlighten, educate, and empower others with the truth. Like it or not, the truth disturbs, the truth divides, but ultimately, the truth delivers. Hey, I'm your host, Phil Rizzo. I'm the principal owner of Rizzo's Protective Group. We are a high-risk security consulting firm headquartered out of Akron, Ohio, and with offices in the Bronx, New York, and Cerro Alto, the Dominican Republic. Hey, as we put the ball on the tee to line things up for kickoff, we speak life, health, and prosperity over each and every one of you, and we want to thank you for joining us. Tonight, on this explosive episode, as Light 'Em Up honors Black History Month, we are thrilled beyond words and honored to sit and talk with one of our dearest friends and most coveted and honored guests of our show, Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. Dr. Womack Jr. is the Region 3 Area Superintendent of the Columbus, Ohio School District, the largest district in the Buckeye State of Ohio, and a lifelong educator with 30-plus years of experience. He's an inspirational, motivational leader, a frequent keynote speaker and role model, and an urban educational transformation expert, as well as the author of two books, the first entitled Even the Best of Plans Go Astray, and Creating Successful Urban Schools, the Urban Educator's Month-by-Month Guide to School Improvement. The cornerstone of Dr. Womack Jr.'s educational philosophy that has led to phenomenal positive outcomes is that exposure changes expectations and experiences change lives. Dr. Womack earned his Ph.D. in educational leadership from Ashland University. He's a Purple Raider through and through, and he's a devout man of learning, wisdom, and history. Most importantly to me, he's a dear friend of mine. In this explosive episode, certainly you need not be a person of color to benefit from the always profound messages shared by Dr. Womack Jr. You need only to be human. Dr. Womack Jr. has been an inspirational light and a Light 'Em Up favorite since his initial appearance on our show in our debut season. That episode aired June 13th of 2020. Hey, don't forget to check out each of his three previous appearances on our show. The most recent entitled, It Isn't How You Start That's Important. It's how you finish, extending faith, hope, and love through progressive education and enlarging our knowledge of history and of self. Always with affection, we refer to him as Dr. Downloads. He's like E.F. Hutton. When he talks, people listen. Hey, Dr. Womack, welcome back to the show. Welcome back to Light 'Em Up.
How you doing, Mr. Rizzo? Good to hear from you, sir. It's been a minute. How are things going for you?
Oh, we're blessed to have you. We really are. We're excited about today's presentation that we're going to share with you, and we're looking forward to it 100%. Glad to have you here, Doc.
Good. Thank you. Glad to be here, Phil.
This is a Black History Month short sojourn with Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. We are delivering a trilogy of episodes. That's right, a three-pack special for Black History Month. This is part A in our series of discussions with Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. Hey, Doc, we are going to dive right into the thick of it straight out of the gate. In order to offset some of the events or endless repetition of events that have taken place recently, in order to have any hope to devise some kind of method or strategy to bring about lasting change, we have to examine the root cause of the problem. James Baldwin said a similar thing when he said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." Oftentimes, when we investigate and interrogate an issue, exposing and examining the root in order to discern the fruit, people think that we are peddling hate. We're not peddling hate. We're peddling the truth. It may come off to some that way because perhaps some dislike the truths that we tell. We know that as plain as day that the truth is under vicious attack. But as always, the truth is worth fighting for. While the truth shall make you free, the speaker of truth sometimes has no friends. Dr. Womack, let's fast forward to today, speaking specifically regarding the vicious beating and death of Tyre Nichols in Memphis, Tennessee, who was beaten by a mob of MPD officers on January 7th, and he succumbed to his injuries, dying on January 10th. Today, we're talking specifically about the repetitious killing of black and brown men by law enforcement. We're talking about the chronic fatigue of extrajudicial policing actions that have disproportionately impacted upon individuals of color and communities of color. We're talking about the pattern and practice of being killed at the hands of the illegal chokeholds, the boot kicks to the head, the above-the-shoulder baton strikes, the multiple taser deployments, and being gunned down in the streets in a hail of bullets. You've been an effective educator for more than a generation. I know from our personal conversations that you've faced head-on some of the most rigorous educational challenges that any educator could possibly face. So my first question to you that I pose is, can you educate out or retrain effectively the culture of aggression, the culture of brutality, the ingrained deception, and the tireless dedication to obfuscate the truth that continues to be a terminal cancer and permeate law enforcement as a profession? Can you train those things out of today's officers?
I ponder that question as you bring it to my attention, because I think any profession where you're required to wear a gun and a taser and a bulletproof vest puts you into a situation where you are normally going to be on the aggression. And it's almost like being in the military. You almost always have to be in a state of mind that anything at any time could happen. And so I don't know if that could be trained out just because of the nature of the job. What I am hoping, though, would be appreciation of life of black and brown people. Because what we've seen over the last few years is that there have been people who've done mass shootings and killings who have been of another persuasion and may have been able to be apprehended without a shot fired. And we've seen on the other end, black and brown people who don't even have a weapon. Tamir Rice, per se, a 13-year-old child, you know, that the police pulled right up on and shot him in a state of Ohio where this is an open carry state. You got a right to carry a weapon whether you have a license to or not. So with that being the case, I think what we have to do is start to have evaluation and appreciation for black and brown life. And, you know, that's very difficult in America because it has not been, it's been undervalued for years. To some extent, which is wild, it may have been more valued when people had to pay for it because it was property. But now it's like we don't appreciate black life, and that makes it very difficult. And even to a certain extent, to look at, not only don't we underappreciate black and brown life, but we have not found a way to help people understand the value of we. Like, we are all, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, you know, provide for pure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense. We forget that the preamble is about we. And as long as we have these two nations separate and unequal, two different sets of rules for police when it comes to black and brown life, I think it is going to be difficult to train or eradicate or take any of that out because there's just a devaluation of the life of black and brown people. There's a quote, it's called Simpson's Creed. And in Simpson's Creed, it starts off with, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You can fill a fool with knowledge, but you can't make him think. You can dress a man in clothes, but you can't give him brains. But it goes on to say in that Simpson's Creed that a rich man will go to trial, but it takes a lot of time. And while a poor man goes to jail, a rich man just pays a fine. And so it is just basically stating, expecting that there are two separate sets of rules here that we have in the United States of America. And how do we get to the bottom and to the nucleus of that? But in regards to your question, can you train that in and can you train that out? I don't know if that's possible, especially in regards to the nature of the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. In your career, you are a proven transformational leader with a proven track record, and you've had to turn around a battleship in a bathtub, so to speak, on many occasions in your educational career in order to save and sustain many of the schools that you've been in a leadership role with. Now, with law enforcement agencies, ultimately the failure is at the top. How do we restore credibility, enhance transparency and accountability in and among the brass who represent police leadership across the country?
A lot of people talk about policies, and you know, they had a George Floyd crime bill that, you know, they're trying to get passed right now in the House and the Senate. And I think, you know, President Biden's talking about executive orders, but executive orders only last as long as that president lasts. I think that's a significant question in regards to responsibility and transparency. I think you kind of put the answer into the question that you just spoke about. We are not very transparent in regards to putting up the numbers, the statistics, the information to show the inequities, the inequalities, the practices that have demonstrated that there are black and brown people who are experiencing violence from the police at disproportionate numbers and rates. While we make up 1 out of 10 people in the country or 2 out of every 10 people in the country in regards to Hispanic Americans, you know, how is it that we are disproportionately incarcerated, disproportionately pulled over and stopped, disproportionately, you know, losing our lives to the police in regards to numbers and ratios? And I think until we become transparent with that information and having a way to communicate it effectively to all parties, not on a small link at the bottom of a 5-page report that has impacted, you know, our people and even in people in a position of leadership, I think it requires a diverse pool of people. My uncle used to always tell me, if you're not sitting at the table, you often end up on the plate. And the people in positions of authority, even in the House and the Senate, don't necessarily look like the major cities in America. Last time I looked at Congress and, you know, I looked at the Senate, it did not look like America. It looked like a large number of Anglo-Saxon white males to have very limited or any amount of dealings with diverse populations other than when it becomes time for elections. Mm-hmm. And so until, you know, the people who touch the work actually know what this work is, until you actually find a way to talk to the people on a day-to-day basis and value it, you're going to continue to see that. So how do we make these numbers more transparent? How do we get this information out into the hands of the people that need it? And how do we, you know, value the lives of the people that we already know? It's almost like going to Atlanta or Washington, D.C. and New Orleans and say, hey, I need to take a census. All you got to do is go from the Lower East Side to Washington, D.C. and Anacostia by Howard University. And you know, in Atlanta, you know those cities are predominantly black. You don't have to bring the census in order to do it. All you have to do is do a straw test. You can look and walk around and see it. We can look and walk around and see on television every day another young black person shot and killed, another young Hispanic person shot and killed, you know, at the hands of our peace officers who are here to serve and protect. And we see this all the time. So how do we go about making that a priority for the people in leadership? Some solutions have been suggested is that there ought to be an insurance clause for any time a police officer has taken the life of a black or brown person when they're unarmed. Other people talk about in our own communities, making sure we have life insurance so that therefore these insurance companies who have to pay out those life insurance policies will start becoming advocates for the groups of people who are disproportionately finding themselves in situations on the wrong end or the short end of the stick at the hands of our law enforcement. So there are people who talk about that, like, hey, if you start getting insurance policies, if you start making sure that the police are responsible for it, and if people start to have to pay for this, not just in a multi-million dollar lawsuit where Benjamin Crump or other people come out and start marching and protesting, but if you start insuring the people whose lives are being lost, insurance companies will start standing up and speaking out in order to say, hey, this is a national problem and it's something that we need to solve. And that means everybody coming to the table collectively in order to talk about it. I found as a school educator, one of the most effective ways to transform and turn around schools is to get the community and the family involved. So whether it be the Chamber of Commerce, whether it be the colleges and universities, whether it be the city council members, whether it be parents in the community, whether it be local ministers, we all met once a month in my schools in order to talk about what can we do collectively with everybody playing their own piece in the puzzle, but recognizing the big picture to help, you know, educate our students. And I believe that that's what we have to do collectively. We want to change some things here. Not only is it the police department, but it's the religious affiliations, it's the colleges and universities, it's the grassroots organizations and efforts, and then put specific measurable goals. I don't know if there's even any specific measurable goals in regards to we want to see a decrease in crime, but can we work on a decrease in the number of people who are losing their lives and being assaulted by the hands of people that we pay to serve and protect? And in order to do that, we would need a baseline, Phil, and not only just the Bureau of Criminal Statistics, but specifically in regards to the lives that are lost to unarmed people. And I think that might be a start with a baseline, so each year we would be able to sit down and say, okay, we're seeing decreases, or we're seeing increases, and what are the things that are contributing to that? But I don't know if we even have a dashboard like that anywhere in the United States of America in order to say, hey, we hear about reductions in crime, we hear about reductions in violent crimes, but what are we talking about in regards to numbers, in regards to loss of life and hostile brutality and things that are going on towards black and brown people in the country? country.
No, I agree. I agree. It's an essential thing, and it's much needed. Very much needed, for sure. The officers who kicked, punched, pepper sprayed, and tased Tyre Nichols, even after he was plainly incapacitated, allegedly over erratic driving, had to have felt empowered in order to behave as they did. You know, they didn't even bother to turn off their body-worn cameras, which recorded every brutal kick and baton strike in the entire deadly savage beating. In the long sequence of high-profile deaths of black men at the hands of the police, the death of Tyre Nichols in Memphis shared many of the same hallmarks. For example, a traffic stop that turns violent, an outraged community, a crucial release of body-worn camera footage. But this case, it was unique in another way. All five police officers charged with murdering Nichols are black, as is the city chief of police, and a majority of Memphis police officers are black as well. You know, we've learned through in-depth analysis that the race of the victim is far more important than the race of the officer doing the brutalizing. For Tyre Nichols, it mattered not that his brutalizers were black. His outcome is the same. Unfortunately, he is dead. Tragically, he is dead. Black police officers have been accused of brutalizing and killing black people before. Three of the six Baltimore police officers charged in the 2015 arrest and death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray were black. So my question is, in your estimation, is it possible that those former officers were driven by something bigger than the ill-conceived and incorrect notion that minorities pose a constant threat to officer safety, such as the historically biased culture of policing, or an ingrained racist ideation that law enforcement possesses towards black and brown individuals of color, which puts black people at an enhanced risk regardless of the officer's race? Or were these specific officers of the law just bad at their professional craft?
You know, I would say two things to answer that question. I think a lot of stuff takes place on a case-by-case basis, but we have disproportionately seen the lives of black people lost at the hands of the police. You got what happened in Akron with Jalen Walker, whose father used to be one of my coaches at Booker High School. You have George Floyd. You got Breonna Taylor. You got Sandra Bland. You have Philando Castile. You have Tamir Rice. We have Timothy and Melissa Williams in East Cleveland. We have Casey Gooden here in Columbus, Alfred Hill. There's another young man who's lost his life at the hands of police and broke into his room, you know, shot him instantly. No weapon, no anything. 20-year-old male. And so we have enough statistics to choke a horse on that situation. But Phil, I believe it starts with two things. There's a book or a letter called the Willie Lynch Letter, and I would recommend that your audience picks it up. But Willie Lynch was somebody who was brought in order to deal with the slave trade, in order to say, listen, you can't keep hanging your African-American property if you are trying to make a profit. And with the invention of the cotton gin, the profits on cotton rose by 1,000%. So just imagine that, man. And so, you know, with the cotton gin now, you could do what you needed to do with the cotton in order to make it ready and prepared to make clothes a lot quicker than you could previously. You're picking it, you're trying to figure out different things to get all of the things out of it. But the cotton gin increased the productivity for Southern farmers by almost 1,000%. That's significant, you know. With that being the case and the economics with it, Willie Lynch came in and he talked about how can we do something that for 400 years will help keep a slave a slave. It's called How to Keep a Slave a Slave, the Willie Lynch Letters. And in the Willie Lynch Letters, he talked about making sure that the field slave had animosity towards the house slave, that the dark-skinned slave had animosity towards the light-skinned slave. He talked about creating a situation where the woman would be so fearful because of what she saw happen to the man that she would protect her children. So you mutilate, you devastate, you incapacitate the black male in front of the woman who then bears child and will be like, hold on, whatever I can do in order because of their nature as a woman and a mother to protect their children. It's just by nature. If they begin to see this, they're going to do everything they can to protect it. And so it becomes a mentality. Carter G. Woodson also stated that once you control a man's thinking, you no longer have to worry about his actions. So as the mind tells you to do, that's what you do. And over the years and after, you know, many generations, you and I have talked about this this before. You know, we were slaves in America longer than we've been free. So we're talking about 1865 with the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which actually ended slavery. But we've been here since 1555. It's not the 1619 project. You already had slaves over here with the Portuguese, with the Dutch, and all of these things that were taking place. So you're really talking about a period of about 310 years until you get to the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which actually ended slavery in this country. And so that mentality has impacted generation upon generation upon generation. And then you have 1865 and 1954, we had separate and inherently unequal in a Supreme Court decision. But during that time, you had slave codes, you had Jim Crow laws, you had Reconstruction for a period of 10 years between 1867 and 1877, where you saw a significant number of African Americans move into position of power based on their numbers in the South. There were actually 10 state representatives and congressmen that were black during 1867 and 1877. As a matter of fact, Phil, there was a black governor by the name of P.B.S. Pinchback in the 1870s because the governor of Louisiana was impeached. So the first black governor in this country was P.B.S. Pinchback in Louisiana. But nobody's teaching that history. But so what happens is each generation begins to have to try and reteach their history over the course of time. And it becomes a mentality. I call it a stinking thinking because you never get a chance to understand the significance of what people have done in this country when you're constantly telling a story. And we have not been able to tell our own story at all. And as a result of it, it becomes a mentality. I do this presentation called Top 10 and bringing this all the way back full circle. And in this presentation called Top 10, I say name 10 famous African-Americans in 1 minute. If you can name 10 famous African-Americans in 1 minute, I'll give you $100. Ready, go. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a speech tonight and I may actually do this. What I found for the last 25 years, I've been doing this presentation from New York to Charlotte, North Carolina, to Savannah, Georgia, to Oakland, California, to Atlanta, to Detroit, to Dallas, to Cleveland, OAPSE, NAPSE, all of these presentations, that what it comes down to, what people name 10 famous African-Americans, is athletes, entertainers, slavery, and civil rights. I don't care where I go. Phil, I never had to get a $100 up. Because when I say take off all the athletes, entertainers, civil rights, and slavery, people have like maybe two or three people left. Yeah. I said, but what about the inventors? What about the pioneers like Sabo, who founded Chicago? What about the inventors of Lewis Latimer, who invented the light bulb or the carbon filament? What about the pioneers in medicine like Dr. Daniel Hale Williams and Charles Drew, who found a way to save blood plasma or did the first successful open heart surgery? What about Benjamin Banneker, who was an engineer who made the first working clock in America, as well as designed the city of Washington, D.C.? What about Bessie Coleman, who is flying planes? Since we're in African American History Month, I think I can bring this to the attention. What about those type of people? Bessie Coleman was flying planes before Amelia Earhart even existed. So those type of things are not taught, and that impacts the mentality because you grew up every generation thinking that African American people have never contributed anything of significance to this country. And that only affects black people, that affects white people too. But it also affects black people in a negative way because you begin to believe that you have never done anything of significance in this country, other than our former president, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, i.e. first black president. But what about all of these years in the elevator, the refrigerator, you know, the traffic light, the two-cylinder engine, the automatic gear shift? All of those were invented by African people, man.
Yeah.
And nobody says anything at all about it. And that's what Dr. Carter G. Woodson speaks on. Once you control a man's mind, you no longer have to worry about his thinking. The mentality of the people who are responsible for enforcing these laws don't even begin to understand that this country was based on the laws of a man by the name of Crispus Attucks, who was the first man to give his life during the Boston Tea Party and before the American Revolution. He was black.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, those are things that are never taught. And when you think about that, if you start teaching these things to people early on, because for whatever reason, man, it just seems like we've lost a lot of love, Phil. Yeah. You know, there used to be a love. It's amazing that, like, tomorrow's the Super Bowl. Almost everybody in this country will probably be watching the game. You have two black quarterbacks for the first time in the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
We've had black players in the NFL for who knows how long. But this is the first time in 2023 that you have two black quarterbacks leading those teams. And I'm watching, you know, Alabama play Auburn, which is some of the most, you know, that's in the state of Alabama. When you look at the audience of the people who are watching the game, as well as the kids who are participating, everybody's cheering. We can come together in sports like no other, you know, vocation in the world. But when it comes to living together, working together, and loving on each other, feel, It's a huge gap. And it's like, how does that mentality impact us? And what is it about a football game or a basketball game or a soccer game that although you may be going against the opposing team, y'all all stand together united in order for your team? I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. When I go to the Pittsburgh Steelers games field, man, white people, black people, Hispanic people, gay, whatever the situation, if you're a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, you're a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. We Americans, man.
Yeah.
We should be American fans.
But
somewhere along the way, because of the way we've been raised, because of the curriculum, because of the, as I say, the teachings, and that separate but unequal, it has impacted us. And if we could find a way to harness the energy that we see at our sporting events and use that collectively, I believe that we as a country would be so much stronger. There are 1 billion people in China. There are 1 billion people in India. America only has 330 million people, man.
Yeah.
So there's countries in that are four times the size of us with homogeneous groups. Like, we have everything here. But in those countries, homogenous groups of people that are 1 billion people standing together collectively. And here we are. Landed a free home in the break, and we cannot find a way to come together other than sports, man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do we use that platform? Our athletes use that platform in order to maybe bring some unity, because I don't care what the legislation, what the policy is, what they're doing in Congress, what they're doing in courts. We've been watching for years, whether it was Kennedy, whether it was the Civil Rights Act, whether it was the Voting Rights Act, whether it was the Fair Housing Act, Equal Opportunity Act, whatever it has been, there has not been a piece of policy or legislation has brought this country together under one umbrella in order to be united. We're still seeing the same thing going on with police. We're still seeing the disproportionate hiring or lack of hiring, fine, health care issues.
Yeah.
But on Sunday, to watch the NFL, we can get everybody together.
Absolutely.
So, you know, those are the type of things that I think we have to figure out how to harness that, because I'm a solutions-based guy, you know.
Yeah, I know. And you spoke to things getting done legislatively, and that leads right into my next question. You know, nothing of any real consequence happened on paper legislatively after George Floyd was killed. And I know that you know.
Absolutely nothing, you know, nothing.
Absolutely. And like I was saying, I know that you know that if it isn't on paper, codified into law, it doesn't exist. And the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was suffocated to death in Congress, just as George Floyd was killed in the streets. What, if anything, do you think this murderous and despicable display of yet another black man being killed in prime time on TV will mean for the policing profession? Will any meaningful legislation be established stemming from the death of Tyre Nichols?
With one color that America understands, and we were talking, that's a great lead in, Bill, I'm glad you said that, is we understand the color green. And if I look at any given game, the Super Bowl is a multi-billion dollar operation. The NFL, the NBA are multi-billion dollar operations. We have NFL players and NBA players and baseball players who are making over $120, $230 million for one person. That's enough money to run a whole country, run a whole city. And that's one person's salary. And so until people start impacting the economics of those cities, you know, and this is the type of stuff that got Dr. King in trouble as well as other organizers, but I bring it to your attention because he started to push Operation Breadbasket, where he said we're going to economically boycott or require that the tax dollars that we place into your city, a certain percentage of those monies are given back to the black community in order to address the things that we need until we start addressing the green and the economic impact of people of color in this country, i.e. when they were talking about the life insurance policies and different things that would be required to impact people's pockets. The one thing America understands is green.
Yeah, no doubt.
We have to find a way to impact the economic landscape in order to bring attention to those things that we already know are unjust, untruthful, unfair, unequal. And until we find a way to do that, Phil, I don't believe anything will change. There's a guy by the name of Derek Bell. And he has a theory called convergence of interest. And what Derek Bell, who's also one of the fathers of critical race theory, along with Kim Crenshaw, basically says is this. Until there's a convergence of interest for the white power structure and the black power structure, and nothing significant will change. And what he was basically saying is, when I do something as a black person that impacts white people, or any other people for that nature, then if we can find a convergence of interest, then we can make significant change. And what he states is very simply this. this, that with the invention of the television and with the invention of multimedia, and what we have is social media now, that people across the world began to look at us as a democracy and say, wait a second, hold on, you are pushing democracy to communist countries like China and Russia, and yet you're saying democracy is the best way to go. You're trying to push this on Cuba and other places as well, too. How can you say that when we can go on television and see black people being fire hosed, dogs bitten, lynched, all of the above? Yeah, you're promoting democracy. But when people got television became readily available like microwaves, they were able to see, like, hold on, America is pushing this and pushing that, but look at what they're doing to this black people in this country. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you push democracy and look how you treat this race of people? So there became a convergence of interest. And we wanted to be recognized as a world power where we had democracy and freedom, then we needed to do some things collectively. And during that time period between 1964 and 1968, there was significant civil rights legislation passed because people all over the world not only began to hear, but began to see what was happening in America. And that was the same thing with George Floyd. During the pandemic, Phil, everybody was sitting at home. Nobody was going anywhere. Yeah. We couldn't. But guess what? Television was on all day long, and they showed George Floyd everywhere, all across the world. And what did you see? Other countries, other continents, all types of people began to stand up, speak up, walk, march, protest. And once they did that, it brought attention to a situation. There became a convergence of interest. And as a result of it, we never took advantage of that momentum in order to ensure that significant legislation was passed in order to address these situations. Mm-hmm. And now, well, hey, we saw Tyree Nichols, but we also saw there were black officers. We have not taken advantage of that time in order to make a significant change. So, you know, I think we have to find a way to harness the momentum and address some of these things. But a lot of it is a mentality field. So we have to impact the pockets. Yeah. We have to find a way to impact the pockets. Best example, and I didn't mean to belabor this answer, is remember in Cincinnati in the 1990s, where there was a significant number of African-Americans killed at the hands of police. One of the things that happened was, and however you feel about Bill Cosby, you feel about Bill Cosby. But Bill Cosby, amongst other African-American leaders at that time, said, hey, we're going to boycott the Jazz Festival. People stopped going to the, I go to the Cincinnati Jazz Festival every year from the time I was 23 to I was about 31 years old. Every year I went to see Frankie Beverly and Maze, Cameo, Mary J. Blige, yeah. Whoever was popular at the time, Joe, sure. See, everybody went to the Cincinnati Jazz Fest.
Sure.
But when they saw the number, disproportionate number of African-American people killed at the hands of the Cincinnati police, they boycotted the city of Cincinnati. We're not going to do any more conventions there. We're not going to go to the Jazz Fest. We're not going to put our money into the hotels and the infrastructure necessary to sustain this city in regards to commerce and things of that nature. They start changing things in Cincinnati. Yeah. They start hiring black police officers, training them in equity. They started to bring on black people in positions of authority. They started to make significant changes in that city. Yeah. And as a result of it, people came back to the Jazz Fest maybe 7 or 8 years later. But what you saw was significant change in that city as a result of the boycotts that took place. And that is some of the things that we have to think about if we want to make change, man. We have to hit people in the pocket.
No, absolutely.
Whether it's our legislators, whether it's, you know, it's got to be economic.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. People hear and people understand the color of money. You know, you had mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I wanted to ask, what, if anything, does this say about our present day situation with race in America, where in the exact same city where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down by an assailant's bullet in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel, black police officers beat a black man in a predominantly black city to death, just as if it were Bull Connor's officers in Birmingham, Alabama?
What it says is we have what's called instinctive thinking. We have a mentality that we don't value our lives, and so why should we worry about other people valuing our lives? And, you know, and that's sad. You know, that's what that Willie Lynch letter, How to Make a Slave and Keep a Slave, is really about. It's about finding a way to divide and conquer within your own race. There's a parable called The Lion and the Goat. It's a story about a lion that was raised by goats as a result of the lion's mother dying. So, and it's an African proverb, but what it basically says is that until you know who you are, somebody else will tell you. And in until you understand your own identity, your own history, you let other people tell the story and make the story up for you. And as a man thinks, those who he also believes. Mm-hmm. And we have to change our stinking thinking. When I mentioned the $100 or the top 10 questions, that's what black, white, poor, that's all people feel. Black people, white people, Hispanic people, they don't know who we are, where we come from, or the contributions that we made to this country. And as a result of it, we are devalued. I was always taught Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, but I was never taught anything positive about myself. And even though Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, that did not change the mind of the people of Memphis. You know, Dr. King was one of the most vilified people at that time. In 1968, when he was assassinated, that was, let's see, that was 13 years after Montgomery Improvement Agency and the bus boycotts. By that time, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party, a lot of people are like, hey, listen, we got to fight back. This peaceful protest and marching is not getting us anywhere. And so, therefore, there were factions in this country, and especially running the Black political party and Black elite, in regards, when I say elite, but the think tank are the people who are making differences. So, you know, that stinking thinking and that mentality is Willie Lynch talked about creating. And it's called, if you do this, he said, this will work for 400 years. Well, he wrote this in the 1700s, man. Here we are in 2023. It's still not 400 years, and it's still a mentality that permeates amongst not only our own community, but the larger community, especially those who are in a position of power and authority. And you see that once you have the Reconstruction period and going back to that from 1867 to 1877, I bring it to your attention again, is because we began to become economically viable, start our own businesses, our own banks, our own schools, our own cities. But then Andrew Jackson comes in and changes everything up. He brings the soldiers out of the South, the Jim Crow laws were put into effect, and we basically became economically destitute and dependent on other people. And so, you know, that's the mentality that we have to change. And we have to start having a love for each other, because the number one cause of death for African-American males between the ages of 15 and 34 is homicide, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, let's think about that. Homicide. And it's not just the police. So until you value yourself, until you know who you are, whose you are, and that's what our proverb is called, the lion and the goat. Until you know who you are, whose you are, your mentality dictates the way that you handle certain situations. We have to change the mindset, and that's difficult because there's no place in the curriculum in public schools, and in many cases, you can't find this history to let you know who you actually are.
Yeah.
And it's a tough place to be in.
No, absolutely. And this is a Black History Month short sojourn with Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. Dr. Womack, I just have one more question, if I could, in this short session that we have with you. In what was termed the long hot summer of 1967, tensions over racial inequality erupted into violence in cities across the United States. This violence was often triggered by a dispute between the police and Black citizens. For example, in Newark, New Jersey, 26 people died in 5 days of rioting after two white police officers beat a Black cab driver during a traffic stop. And 56 years ago, NAACP leader Roy Wilkins was a guest on the TV show called Meet the Press, and he called for better policing then. Now, 56 years later, and we still haven't found what we're looking for in effective, consistent, and good community policing. How do we go about getting the 21st century policing that we need in our communities?
I would say two things. You know, that summer violence is what prompted the Kerner Report and the Kerner Commission. So since we have a well-educated group of individuals who listen to your podcast, you mentioned some very interesting information. Those riots took place in Detroit, Newark, Los Angeles, Miami, Chicago, all over the United States. Even prior to Dr. King being assassinated, there were race riots going on, many of them the results of police brutality and the assaults of African Americans at the hands of the police. Man, it was going on in Los Angeles. It went on in Collinwood and Cleveland. This took place in Chicago. This took place in Los Angeles. This took place in Detroit. And so as a result of it, Lyndon B. Johnson, who's the president, started what was called the Otto Kerner Commission. So you have a well-educated audience. They would like to, I would suggest they look up what's called a Kerner Report. Mm-hmm. And the Kerner report came up with some real summaries and solutions. And what Kerner found out, he said, we have two nations, separate and unequal. And the cause of much of this violence is very simply this: racism, whether it be inequity in education, inequity in healthcare, inequity in jobs, inequity economically. People see it. It's blatant inequity in regards to the justice system. And so he said the cause was racism. His findings and his summary with his commission, with all of the governors that were part of it, congressmen, senators, professors, he said that we have two nations, separate and unequal. And what black people know, that is, there is a significant amount of racism in this country. He listed that as the number one cause of all of these racial violence that was taking place at that time. The Otto Kerner Commission, he states specifically that the issue is racism and how it impacts economics, education, healthcare, housing. And until we address the racism in this country, whether it's by police or whomever, because he talked about the justice system, the criminal justice system specifically, he mentions all of that in this report. This is the Kerner report. None of this is new, Phil. The thing about it is, it's new to everybody, because if you don't ask the right question, you don't get the right answers. And so people are not even willing to read their history. And when you don't read your history, you're not familiar with it, you're disdained to make the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So, you know, to get back to the answer to your question, in a solutions-based approach, I think we need to start, number one, I know this may sound wild and it's an allegory, but we got to start loving each other as American citizens and look at each other as equal. You know, we don't do that. It's still separate and unequal. And those in positions of power are so busy trying to hold on to the power that they don't understand that, you know, nobody gets to stay, man. Everybody got an expiration date. You can hold on to this power as long as you want to. But if we don't pass it on to the next generation, we as a country may find ourselves, you know, in a subservient position to some of these larger countries because we are not standing together collectively. You know, united we stand, divided we fall. How do we come together collectively under a common interest of what can we do for the next generation, which is our children, in order to impact and sustain and improve what America was really built on? And we know it was built on a solid foundation, even though it was built on a foundation based on white males making decisions and following legislation and policy that would benefit them. But over the course of time, we have been able to morph into a society where over 51% of the kids in public schools right now feel like kids of color. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't say suburban. I'm saying public schools, for the most part, where you get not the suburban school districts, but the urban and public schools, 51%, man, are students of color. And so what does that say about what the teaching force should look like? So there are some things that we just have to come together collectively on. And I think, as you said, and you were right on point, that leadership is trying to get as wealthy as they can get, not recognizing that it's going to impact the children. And eventually, if you don't plant them in fertile soil, man, they're not going to grow. And we have to find a way to collectively talk about the impact that all people in this country have made to making it a better place. Because right now, the Republicans are falling out with the Democrats, the liberals are falling out with the conservatives. It's just, we're just really bipartisan right now. And Phil, you said something before in our first interview, Community or Chaos, mm-hmm. that are we facing civil war? Man, that was well before January 6th of 2000. What was that, 21?
Yeah.
I was like, Phil almost must have knew that this was going to take place. Like, you had made a prediction that was so on point that I had no idea that had gotten that deep in regards to people feeling that privilege that they could go to the Capitol building and have an insurrection about what? About a vote?
Yeah. From physical security being what I do for a profession, I could just see that things were deteriorating to the point to where we were closer than we had ever been at any other time since the Civil War ended to Civil War. Absolutely.
Yeah. You said that. It was almost like, I was like, man, I should have got a lottery number for you. Because, you know, you predicted it. You were just like, hey, are we? And I was just like, well, I don't know if we're at that point yet. January 6th, I watched it.
No, absolutely.
I watched it.
It played out on TV, you know? I mean, and I still don't think we're very far from where we were when January 6th took place. I think it's a matchstick away from the same thing. I think it really is. We are delivering a trilogy of episodes. That's right. It's a 3-pack special for Black History Month. And this is the first. This is going to be part A in our series of discussions. This is a Black History Month short sojourn with Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. And Dr. Womack Nomek, we're honored to always have a chance to talk with you, and we are really looking forward to the next two installations. For certain, we thank you for your wisdoms, and we know we'll get a chance to talk some more, so this isn't goodbye. This is just a temporary pause for the cause. As you know, we take a deep dive on the criminal justice system, crime scene investigation, and leadership. We enlighten, educate, and empower others with the truth. Like it or not, the truth disturbs. The truth divides, but ultimately, the truth delivers. Dr. Womack, thanks so much for being with us, and we want to give you a chance just to close us out.
Well, I would like to say thank you, number one, Phil, for constantly bringing deep discussions on topics that many times only get surface-level attention. You always have a significant number of questions that require in-depth thought and research, and I've always said if you don't ask the right questions, you will not get the right answers. And so I thank you for the opportunity to express my opinions and my thoughts, and I just thank you for the level of questioning and the in-depth research that you do prior to these sessions. So, man, you take care of yourself. Have a great evening, and looking forward to talking to you soon. I also want to say that I just wrote another book. It's called The Leadership Manual for Creating Successful Urban Schools. It's a manual for urban education leaders in order to try to change around the all-too-predictable outcomes for kids of color or kids of poverty. And it's a proven technique, so it can always be found on my webpage, which is urbanschooleducation.com. I would recommend people try to check that page, urbanschooleducation.com, and there are significant resources, many of them free, as well as a store that will allow you to purchase some of those books, as well as to hear some of the articles and get some of the things that I've written recently, whether it be Educational Week, Principal Leadership, School Leadership Magazines. Those links are on there as well, so you can read some of my thoughts and opinions on different things that it takes in order to meet the needs of our youth in urban education.
Absolutely. And give us the name of your new book, the title of it again.
It's called The Leadership Manual for Creating Successful Urban Schools.
Okay. We'll definitely add that in the liner notes for this specific episode. And we encourage all of our listeners to take advantage of Dr. Womack's new book. And we're going to talk more later about his two previous books that he's already written. And we're looking forward to that very much so. Dr. Womack, thanks so much for your time. Thanks so much for all that you do.
Thank you, Brother Rizzo. Good to hear from you. 1040 Proud, sir.
Hey, I want to thank my friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting. Their fresh-squeezed hydrating green tea, loaded with amino acids and antioxidants, help replenish and neutralize skin for that natural glow. You want to know the best part? Their tea is organically grown and chosen for skincare from 3,301 Korean native green tea varieties. The winning 1-2-3 punch combination consists of the youth enhancing serum with black tea. Then you just dap a little bit of the eye serum underneath your eyes, and finally the enhancing cream. Oh my goodness. Like Muhammad Ali used to say, I'm pretty, I'm still pretty. They offer innovative beauty solutions for men, also powered by the finest natural ingredients, responsibly sourced from Korea's pristine Jeju Island. Their proprietary extraction methods preserve the purity and potency of these wholesome ingredients from plant to bottle to your skin, offering advanced formulas that safely address all skin concerns without the use of harmful chemicals and preservatives. With the wonders of nature at the heart of Innisfree, they take care to preserve and protect the environment in all that they do. We want to thank our friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting of Light 'Em Up. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube and Instagram at Rizzo's Protective Group. We're very excited about being ranked 10th out of the top 35 criminal justice podcasts as ranked and listed by FeedSpot. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to FeedSpot at www.feedspot.com. And please, por favor, per favore, visit our friends at https://newsly.me. Newsly is an audio app for iOS and Android. It picks up web articles about the most trending topics on the web at any given moment and reads them to you in a natural human voice. For the first time in the history of the internet, the entire web becomes listenable. You can browse articles from topics you choose and start playing. Hey, stop scrolling, start listening. You can follow any topic, as specific as you like, from sports, science, to Bitcoin. It'll find you the latest articles and read them to you. Hey, it's as easy as that. And to top it off, they have podcasts as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 50 countries. Our podcast, Light 'Em Up, is there too. I started using it as my default podcast app, and you can too. Download and use Newsly for free now from www.newsly.me or from the link in the podcast description liner notes and use the promo code Light 'Em Up. And Light 'Em Up in this case is spelled L1GHTEMUP. All one word. That's L1GHTEMUP. All one word.